Welcome to the Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. The knives are out for David Cameron. 95 Tory MPs have written demanding that Parliament get to veto EU laws, which some say is designed to force the PM's hand and to push the UK towards the exit. We talked to the maverick MP Douglas Carswell about what he and his backbench friends are really up to. Also, ruddy hell the movies are going to the dogs. Why the censors are getting softer on foul language in films. I'm joined in the studio by Douglas Carswell MP and by The Telegraph's Graham Archer, the arts editor Sarah Crompton, and the chief movie critic Robbie Collin. No one seems to trust David Cameron, not even his own party. Even though he's promised an in-out referendum, 95 Tory MPs have written to him demanding that he give Parliament the right to veto EU legislation. The problem? They think that Cameron's secretly pro-EU, and that he'll campaign to stay in no matter what. Just as big a problem are those maverick MPs who are secretly anti-EU and want to pull out at any cost. It all feels like a replay of the 1990s, a nice, wet Tory PM brought low by a rebellious party that won't trust him as far as they can throw him. So are the backbenchers fighting the good fight for British sovereignty, lower taxes and decent traditional Tory policies, or are they simply messing things up and letting Ed Miliband into number 10 through the back door? Douglas Carswell, you wrote a passionate blog for us about why you back that letter signed by the 95. How would you define your position?
Well, first of all, there's nothing secretive about my position. You introduced MPs as having a secret agenda.
Okay.
There's no secret about me wanting Britain to withdraw from the European Union. I've been very explicit about it.
But those 95, it's secret in the sense that that 95 claim to want to reform it, but the goal is really to push the government into a position whereby it has to campaign for
My position is to do all I can to try to get the government to
move
into a position where it abandons the idea that we should remain part of the European Union. But I'm so explicit about that, I've written blogs explaining this.
I know. Okay.
But let's be clear. I think everyone just needs to slightly calm down. And I think the parliamentary party needs to stop communicating with each other on this issue through the media and actually talk to each other sensibly. We can all agree with the outline strategy that David Cameron put forward a year ago at Bloomberg. This is a renegotiation followed by in-out. Even someone like me who believes we should withdraw from the European Union subscribes to that and signs up to that. The issue is what sort of new deal, what sort of renegotiation might you try and get? And it's not surprising that there will be some MPs like Bernard Jenkin and Bill Cash and others who've come up with a proposal. And I was happy to put my name to it. There are other ideas. Andrea Leadsom and her team are coming up with other ideas. I was at a meeting this morning, an informal discussion with colleagues where other colleagues were coming up
The point is that Bernard Jenkin's proposal is an impossible proposal. Because it basically means leaving the EU. To say that Britain can veto anything that comes from the EU.
Hang on a second. The German Supreme Court has said that EU treaties apply because the court has said they could apply. We're just seeking for our parliament and our country the same circumstances and conditions that Germany has. It's just putting us on a level playing field with Germany. Now, I make no secret. I want Britain to leave the European Union. And that is what I'm, one of the reasons why I'm in politics. Correct.
Right. Okay. Graham Archer.
Do you see, though, how that must play in the media? You heard it in Tim's eloquent introduction, that you start with, I want to discuss our relationship with EU, and we're all adult members of the legislature here. And that gets translated into headlines in the media about Tory split. Do you have any inner turmoil at all about the impact that causes on the party's standing with the public? And more than that, how much do you struggle as one of the alpha plus 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 minds in Parliament with the tension between sublimating yourself into this thing, the Conservative Party that has to win elections, and the reason why you went into politics in the first place, which was to put forward the ideas eloquently?
By campaigning for British withdrawal very explicitly, I managed to turn a Labour-held seat into a seat with, I'm fortunate, over half the vote. Although I take nothing for granted in politics, the fact is that I suspect that actually if you're pretty straight with people about Europe and you say you want out, you will find that actually it wins support. Now, it may not win support from people in SW1, people in Europe and people who write leaders for The Economist and the FT may not like you, but they don't live in Clacton.
No, but I think Graham's bigger point is, if you don't mind, Graham, that by saying all of this, you make it much harder for David Cameron to win the next election because you give the impression of a divided party. And that lets Ed Miliband in, who will not even give the country a referendum.
Yeah,
so how do you judge, do I remain quiet about this or do I speak up about this? Because I could end up just simply not rocking the boat, but actually sinking the boat.
I think we're all agreed that the Bloomberg strategy, which is to agree to an in-out referendum preceded by an attempted renegotiation, we can all agree to that. The problem is that in politics, as in nature, when there's a vacuum, people are, you know, you're talking about 300 or 400 people who went into politics in order to influence public policy. Of course, they're going to have ideas about what that renegotiation should look like. One way we could ensure that we don't find ourselves at loggerheads is perhaps if the leadership were to suggest what sort of New Deal they might want.
Right.
The fact that we've not had any indication of that means that people are starting to project into that blank space some ideas. Actually, that could be a constructive process, not a destructive process. Look, I'm not going to go to the wall. I'm not going to die in the ditch over this proposal, this letter. It was one suggestion. There are others, and, you know, more the merrier.
Maybe suggesting that there's a lag between what politicians are doing and how the media responds to it, and I must be careful what I say here, but the fact, Tim, that you and I default to language of 1990s Tory splits when we're talking about an entirely new generation of politicians must be frustrating for those members of Parliament who do just want to articulate the views that brought them into politics in the first place.
That's a fair question.
If you stop and think about it, I imagine many of your listeners in their everyday lives, if they have conversations about Britain's relationship with Europe, probably hear a range of views, a range of opinion. Public policy is being changed, it's being developed. The idea that you're going to have, you know, mid-1990s style, a uniformity of views so that all politicians, all people wearing blue rosettes the next election are going to talk in clichés about Europe, it's absurd. It's also inauthentic. One of the reasons why a new third party has come along and gained quite a lot of market share is because it actually is seen, rightly or wrongly, to talk with authenticity. This is a new area of public policy. We need new ideas and we need to have an honest conversation and we should talk genuinely rather than in cliches.
Right. It's my biggest regret about coalition with a capital C, actually, not that I wanted to be in bed with Liberal Democrats, but I did think the fact that the two parties were clearly going to work together in the national interest and therefore would not get all the activists like myself most wanted would mean that we'd be able to view disagreements between adults in the light of, well, they're reasonable adults. Of course, they're not going to agree about everything. And yet within a year, we defaulted to a Liberal doesn't agree with a Conservative. Is the government at risk? I find that faintly depressing.
Why do we get this idea from that if there's uniform opinion behind the formation of public policy, it's going to be better
public
policy?
That's what brought us into Europe in the first place.
Under the old Soviet system, I'm sure if you looked at the parliaments of Bulgaria or Ukraine, there would have been a great deal of consensus.
Yes.
Did it mean they were better government? Making public policy is a messy process. You need dissenting voices.
Well, let's pick up on that, partly because you two are agreeing too much.
Sorry.
Let's pick up on this point about the relationship between the MP and the government. I mean, you are there to support the government to some degree because it's by you being in Parliament that makes that government possible because you vote
I'm there to support the manifesto and to support the government on confidence and supply, and I'm there to support what's in the manifesto unless my own election address dissented
right.
from it.
But Graham, I think you and I might see politics entirely unfairly, perhaps, through the prism of what the government thinks rather than what Parliament thinks.
For Clacton, however admirable he may be.
I'm not a member of the government. I never have been. I never stood for office saying, vote for me, I'll be a member of the government. I'm a member of the legislature. I'm the member of Parliament for Clacton, not a minister.
But the executive continues as long as it has a majority support of the members of the legislature.
Until 1918, if someone like me had been invited to join the government by the Prime Minister, or rather by the Crown, I would have had to resign my seat and stand in a by-election. You know, the idea of a separation of powers is not alien to our tradition. We need to remember that people are elected as MPs to Parliament unless, at the time of the election, they're specifically part of the executive or shadow executive team.
I don't know if you saw Peter O'Born's piece this morning. Hard to read it without seeing an implied rebuke to members such as yourselves, where he laments
the headline, It's hard not to agree with the 95 Conservative MP's letter on curbing EU powers, but it has rekindled a civil war in the party.
He laments the passing of what was once referred to unprepossessingly as backwoodsmen, not a nice phrase. But I think I agree with him to the extent that politics is, yes, it's about fighting for ideas and articulate them as well as one possibly can. It's also important that it's an act of sublimation. It has to be about giving up on all the things that I, as an individual, most want right now, and immersing myself in a bigger entity, mm-hmm. which won't push for everything I want all the time. And I do worry, I would not accuse yourself of this at all. You're not one of the people I think of, but there are perhaps too many MPs who see their function to rattle off what their ego is insisting that they acclaim.
I would say the biggest problem in politics is that too many MPs regurgitate the line to take rather than tell us what they really think. But that's let matters rest. I mean, Peter's article is, as always, magnificent. But this week he's decided to defend, in effect, the old school culture of deference in Westminster. Just pause for a second. I'm speaking inside the Daily Telegraph offices. It was the Daily Telegraph who exposed so brilliantly one of the consequences of that culture of deference in Westminster. It meant that for many, many years, MPs hoovered up public money through an expense system that was put in place in an era when people deferred to the judgment of the whips. Look where that got us. It didn't just mean that Parliament came up with the most appalling system of expenses. It meant that Parliament was monumentally useless as successive governments took executive decisions that ran this country into the ground. I think Parliament needs to recognise it is not there to be deferential. I do not think that deference has any place in our democracy. One of the reasons why this country, I think, is in the state that it is because it has been led by people who have been far too deferential to people to whom they should never have deferred.
But Parliament does have to offer some sort of leadership. It does have to permit a government to function. And if it cannot, if the consensus is there for it, it will bring it down. But if the Prime Minister, a Tory Prime Minister, has proposed a referendum...
Should MPs have deferred to the Syria vote? Because the other week I remember Peter saying it was wonderful that Parliament had stood up. Should we have deferred to the Foreign Office poobahs over Syria?
Would you propose that we revert to that more American-type system where there is a separation?
It's not an American system. It's a British system that we've lost sight of. Until 1918, there was a clear distinction between those who were in the executive and those who were in the legislature. I'm familiar with the argument about deference. I'm here to say I don't think it's the way to run a country. It's no way to run a party, it's run this country into the ground.
No, but if you're along,
the word I use wasn't I expect members of Parliament to be to show deference and to act like poodles for the whips. Absolutely not. But then you attack us when we
stand up for our conscience and our constituents.
You can't have it both ways, and that's why I'm asking.
Because what you're doing could end up undermining the grander cause of Euroscepticism. Because if it means that the government is destroyed, if the Tory party is pulled apart by this argument, it could mean that David Cameron doesn't win in 2015, which means the country doesn't get the referendum that we all want, right?
One of the reasons why we've been offered a referendum in the first place is because in October 2011, 81 Tory MPs were prepared to define a three-line whip. Again and again and again, it has been members of the legislature making the argument and ensuring that we get the change we want. Now, I welcome the fact that number 10 is strongly in favour of an in-out referendum. I think that can unite us. But the idea that somehow we've got to turn around and blame those pesky, troublesome MPs, it's the legislature that means the executive has done the right thing.
So I want to go back to that point.
Last point, Graham.
Pushing at, would you prefer that we completely separated the executive and we went back to that 1918 system such that when a member of parliament was appointed to government, he or she had to resign his seat and seek a fresh mandate, I guess, as being a representative of the government?
There's a far better way of doing it, which I outline in a book I co-wrote with Daniel Hannan called The Plan, available from all good bookshops and the Amazon for £10. But there's a better way of doing it. And I think the really key way of doing it is through open primaries, because that would mean that members of the legislature were actually vulnerable to the wishes of the people they're meant to represent.
Graham, yes or no?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Good. Okay. Douglas Carswell and Graham Archer, thank you both very, very much. In 1969, the British film censors made history. They let Barbara Windsor's breasts pop out on screen in the saucy romp Carry On Camping. The censor at the time explained, "I don't think Miss Windsor's right nipple is going to corrupt the nation." Well, 40 years later and we have riots, swinging, and a campaign to legalise pot, so maybe he was wrong. I'm joking, of course, but many people are outraged at recent news that the British Board of Film Classification has decided that children should be allowed to see more swearing in contemporary movies, on the grounds that swearing has become, quote, commonplace. The Wolf of Wall Street, for example, could be made a 15, despite the fact that it features 506 different F-bombs. And so the age-old debate about censorship resurfaces. What's too much? What's the parent's responsibility? And where will it all end? And, of course, who will think of the children? Sarah Crompton, you've looked at the BBFC's proposals, and what do you think about them?
Well, I actually think they're quite sensible. Mm-hmm. I think they're quote extensively from parents such as myself, and it sounds like sitting at my own breakfast table discussing what should and should not be allowed. And I think it's quite a sensible move that they are making, at one end to say that in the lower classifications, U, PG, that swearing should not be there, because that is the one point at which you absolutely are trying to protect childhood innocence, even against very small words. But that by the time children are 15, that the tone should have been set somewhere else. And it's right. In the 15 category that they're specifically loosening it. And actually, I don't think Wolf of Wall Street would ever be a 15, because it's not just a swearing.
Right, okay.
It contains enormous amounts of gratuitous sex,
I've not
drug
seen it,
taking, and all of which are absolutely not going to come under the 15 certificate.
Right.
So I think, I think it is quite sensible. What I think as a parent is that it feels a bit like Canute standing by the sea shouting at the waves. But I actually think that's quite a good thing, because if somebody doesn't shout at the waves, then your kids haven't got any idea of where the lines are. So I think they've made a sort of sane decision in order just to give parents better guidance.
Just picking on something you said very quickly, does that mean that in U's and PG's at the moment there might be a little bit of swearing?
Well, the word that was complained about was crap. Which comes up in Pirates. And a lot of parents were, and meaning they are reported as saying that they were upset by that word, because it wasn't a word that their very young children, who had gone to see a cartoon, effectively, would expect to come across. And so it's that kind of thing. And I think that is sensible. I think...
Because there might be a version of Mary Poppins that I've not seen with a lot of swearing in.
No, I mean, it's small tweaks. And I mean, that is, and the other thing that the Board of Certifications say, and I think this is important because we are talking about film, but in fact, where children are most exposed, where young people are most exposed to swearing, unsuitable behaviour, early sexualisation, it's in pop videos and gaming, both of which the current board has very little control over.
Robbie, do you agree with all of that?
I do broadly, yes. I think these are very sensible new guidelines. And the reason that they're sensible is because they're looking at context. And beforehand, sometimes with particularly when it came to bad language, you would have a kind of a quota of F words or even C words that you could get away with in a certain certificate. And beyond that point, it would then move up automatically to the next level. And what the BBFC are saying...
It
was counted, yes. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily just come to the decision on the basis of numbers, but the numbers would play a big part in that. Now they're looking at context. So, if say, for example, the C word is used playfully or as a kind of a joshing insult in a film, it won't be counted as harshly as if it was used as a straightforward term of abuse.
Right.
So that is very clever. The place where I think they might get into slightly sticky territory is that they're also looking at tone. This is as a result of one of the most complained about films in recent memory, I think over the last 4 or 5 years, is The Woman in Black, the horror film that starred Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah.
Now, The Woman in Black was originally going to be certified 15, and it wasn't, there was no bad language in it, there was no violence in it. It was just because it was an incredibly scary film. It was very, very tense. All of those horror film tricks, the kind of blank space on the screen where something could jump out at you, the very, very long build-ups, the music, the atmosphere was just perfectly, perfectly cultivated. And it was just too scary. And the BBFC said, you need to kind of dampen down some of these scenes, just make them less agonising, and then we can pass it at 12A. So it was passed at 12A, and it was passed at 12A with a special disclaimer that, even though this was a 12A, it was a very scary film.
Right.
But parents saw Daniel Radcliffe on the poster and they thought, oh, it's Harry Potter, we can take our kids to this, and it's a 12A, so they'll be fine. And these kids were totally traumatised by the film, and it is very scary. As an adult, I was terrified by it.
Right. isn't that though part of movies, that young people try and break in and see them?
Well, I agree, and I think that there is a certain amount of, you know, transgressiveness in watching a film. The thing to remember about BBFC is that when we say they're involved in censorship, they're not involved in terms of, you know, blocking people, you know, this kind of content from being seen in the UK full stop. They do two things. One of the things is to provide a kind of a consumer advice service. So you can look up, if you want to, any film on the BBFC's website. It takes 2 minutes. You know, it's not a time-consuming process. And they will describe, you know, what's in the film, what you can expect to see, and how, you know, offended you might be by the content.
Right.
The other thing to do is to make sure children don't see this content and you know, to kind of legislate against that. Because, right, you know, for the same reasons that we don't let children vote or smoke at the age of
but
8.
But, Sarah, I bet no parents do that. I had no idea you could go on a website and see exactly
I totally. Because actually, I think the other thing that it is now called a board of classification, isn't it, and certification. So they stop the idea that it's a censor. And I think parents do actually look at what the area of concern is. And certainly that would come into play when you're watching movies at home, which, of course, you can more and more with you know, all the devices that bring movies into your home, whether it's a Skybox or Netflix or whatever. Then that is a really useful place to go and say, so I might personally, you know, allow moderate sex. I'm quite against horror and violence, so I would say, well, we're not watching that as a family. But we did recently, as a family, with a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old, watch We're the Millers, which is a deeply unsuitable film. It's incredibly funny.
It's very funny. Yeah.
But it is unsuitable, but I felt that in the context of watching it all together, it would be all right. And I think that is why the guidelines are really helpful. I mean, it will exactly tell you what to expect.
If it's not censorship, sorry if these questions are very ignorant, but if it's not censorship, then does that mean cinemas don't turn people away if they are not?
They do turn people away. I mean,
is that a point of law, or is that a point of,
I think it's a point
commercial
of
practice.
It's a point
it's
of law.
It's legal.
Yeah.
Right.
And so if they're caught allowing 12s into, I think the area they most turn away as sort of 15, it's the 15-12 area where it's quite clear 12-year-olds trying to get into a 15. And I think, you know, certainly I have known children who have been turned away.
In the feedback in the BBFC's report, actually, the one age group that disagreed most often with BBFC's ratings were 15-year-olds, because this is first time I think they've actively talked to teenagers about their views on certification. And of course 15-year-olds are going to say that, because, you know, the ones who are old enough to get in are going to say, you know, oh yes, it was exactly right, and the ones who were turned away are going to say, no, it should have been lower. That element of having, you know, of wanting to see something that you're not allowed to, I think is kind of understandable. It's more a case of when children are too young to make any kind of rational, you know, decision about what they can and can't see.
Right.
That's more of a problem, of course, with video games and with music videos and also with online pornography. And if you read, as Sarah said, if you read the report, the responses from parents, I mean, it's just this kind of outpouring of anxiety over the content of what children are seeing, and the things that they worry about are not really films. It's stuff that they can find online. And of course, what the BBFC allows is it's a rare kind of an instance where parents can say, okay, we do have some informed feedback on this stuff.
Yeah.
And we can set down some ground rules about what our children can and can't see.
Do you think there's been a change historically? I mentioned at the beginning the Barbara Windsor thing. I mean, that's an example of what cinema will and will not show being driven by the culture. You know, by the late 60s, Bridget Bardot, all that sort of thing had changed people's attitudes towards female nudity, so it was okay to show it. So that's a conversation within cinema itself. But when it comes to technological change, cinema and its classifications are just driven by outside forces. I mean, I'm thinking of when video nasties first emerged in the early 80s, and for a little while VHS isn't rated. And that's something which cinema has to catch up with, and the censors have to catch up with, and now we have the internet. Is it just the case that the technology makes it impossible to sort of for cinema to be any kind of trendsetter of what's acceptable or not?
Well, I think ultimately the technology means that if you're determined to see a film, even if it's banned in this country, you can see it. But even, you know, what you have to bear in mind is that the audiences for these films are vanishingly minute. I mean, there was a film recently, The Human Centipede. I won't go into, you know, detail. you don't really want to know.
Yeah.
Nobody went to see The Human Centipede. Now, you know, probably about half of that film's audience were critics that turned up to review it. And, you know, so the problem of this incredibly extreme content that's being distributed as a film is not really that big. It's the kind of the danger areas aren't at the spiky end of the spectrum. It's down, you know, the border between PG and 12A, the border between 12A and 15, and also with the bad language and using PGs. Those are the kind of areas the BBFC is trying to take care with.
Okay.
And I do feel, I mean, I feel as a parent that I am worried by how high the barriers are increasingly set. I mean, that one of the parents quoted in the report quotes the use of the C word by Sarah Millican in a TV show. And I, like that parent, was shocked by it. And it just passed without kind of notice. I think there is a responsibility on sort of people who are making content that they know teenagers will view, at least to think about what they are producing. I certainly think comedians' use of bad language is a much greater concern to me than many other areas that are covered by this report. I also think that the business about gaming is the real key area, because you ask yourself as a parent, which do you prefer? Do you prefer your son watching what is an eminently funny film, or sitting which has got some bad language and the idea that a woman is a prostitute? I mean, those are the two things against We're the Millers.
There is a moral plot around which those things are.
And it's about families and
it's
about
love. It's a deeply moral film, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's a good film. Or do you want them to sit and shoot people for 5 hours? And I think that to me is a much greater concern.
Sarah and Robbie, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.